Okay, we're so glad you're back with us for another GoldSeek.com Radio Gold Nugget segment. Today's special guest, Dr. Stephen Lieb from The Complete Investor. Well, my featured guest today, Dr. Stephen Lieb, 25 years of investment experience, author of 7 best-selling books, including The Oil Factor, Coming Economic Collapse, Game Over, his latest, Red Alert, and, of course, anticipating the gold book that I assume he's penning and working on this morning. Welcome back, Dr. Lieb.
Well, I am. I've interviewed a couple of people. I've done almost all my research, and the more I do, the more I'm convinced that this is probably the last great bull market that we're looking at.
Wow.
We'll be in gold.
That's an interesting comment. Seems like almost everyone on my show shares the characteristic. They are skeptics by nature. I think any good scientist is a skeptic. I mean, that's the hallmark, I think, of the scientific method. But I've noticed a sort of a sea change in that thinking. Let's say the last 20 or 30 interviews of 2016, I don't attribute it just to this remarkable 18 to 20% climb in gold, and their work indicates that the worst has passed for the precious metals and a nadir might be in place.
Yes, I mean, basically, I would agree. But, you know, to say that a nadir is in place, yes, I think the chances are greater now than at any time, certainly in the last couple of years, that we've seen some sort of bottom. The question is when it really starts to explode. There are so many paradoxes around gold, Chris. You know, most recent, I mean, it just seems to track paradoxes. I mean, because it's, you know, it's a metal that's very rare, relatively speaking. It's a metal that is coveted for reasons that we really can't explain other than, you know, its special properties. It doesn't oxidize. I mean, you can go, there's a litany of special properties that, you know, tell you why people have treasured it, think it's beautiful, et cetera. It's hard to, you know, get your handle around it. When oil goes up, when copper goes up, you know, you can say it's a supply-demand imbalance. But here, the source of the imbalance is almost never really industrial. It's never really what we need gold. Sometimes you need silver because it's the best conductor in the world. It's the most reflective commodity in the world. But you never really need gold in the sense that the world's going to stop revolving if you don't have it. There are plenty of metals in which that's true. Gold has this very special cast to it. Maybe that explains why there are so many unusual characteristics that surround its trading. And more than just its trading, its perception. I mean, just one of the facts that, you know, is right in front of us. I'm being a reporter now, Chris. I'm not saying anything that's controversial. I'm just telling you what the numbers show. You know, people, as you said, the last 16 or so interviews, people are getting a little bit more bullish on gold. Well, this is, in a sense, I understand it totally. But in another sense, it's just incredibly surprising because gold all along, since the beginning of this century, since China joined the World Trade Organization, really at the beginning of the century, and China's growth really took off, gold has been by not just a small measure, but by a very large measure, the best performing asset class around. Gained well over 300%, multiplied more than fourfold, and no other asset has come close. I mean, I think the S&P 500 may be up 40%, as an example. Bonds have not come close. Obviously, the gains in gold themselves tell you that it's dramatically outperformed the dollar, dramatically outperformed oil. But even more than that, if you take this century and you say, well, really, how can you, you know, look at 15, 16 years and just take it as a whole? You know, we've had the first half through 2007 or the third quarter of 2007, which was characterized by sharply rising commodity prices led by oil. And then you've had the second half, in which oil did an about face. I think it may be reversing now, parenthetically. But anyway, the second half, oil did an about face, went down. Commodities peaked in 2011, and, you know, precious metals came down in 2013. But even with the big drop you had in gold in from 2011 to 2013, gold has been the best performing asset in both parts of this century. When commodities were rising, gold was the best performing asset. When commodities were falling, gold has been the best performing asset, outperforming bonds, outperforming stocks, certainly outperforming cash, and certainly gaining on the dollar and other currencies as well. So looked at from that perspective, that, you know, when the world changed at the beginning of the century, you know, I know you can, you know, I'm trying to head off an argument that someone would make, well, what's 15 or 16 years in the context of 250? Well, typically not too much, unless those 15 or 16 years are characterized by a major sea change. And you did have a major sea change, and it's called China, and it's called the rise of the East, more generally speaking, because China, you know, means to take the rest of the East with them. They want to be the Middle Kingdom again. After all, that's where they've been for the last 4,000 years, the Middle Kingdom, the center of the East. And the East, you know, as we know, I think much of the growth that's left in this world of ours is going to come from the East. So you did have a sea change at the beginning of this century. And during different parts of that change, during, you know, different, you know, different dynamics characterizing that change, gold remains the best performing asset. So it's as if people have had blinders on, and I'm not taking aim at anybody, because I was as surprised as anybody when I started looking at these statistics. I'm not criticizing anybody. I'm just saying, you know, it's the way the press looks at it. I think they're surprised. I mean, and it's annoying to me. It's very upsetting to me on one level. I'm old enough where I think I can worry about other people in this world. And I see what's going on in America today. And, you know, I'm not going to make any specific comments about the political process that we're seeing at this point, but it's certainly something I've never seen in my lifetime. And I'm a good deal older, I would say, than, you know, many of your interviewees. It could have been a little bit different if, let's say, at the beginning of the century, your certified financial planners, the people that advise other people what to do and how to hold their assets, had said, well, you know, it probably makes sense given that, you know, the world's becoming a little bit different, especially after 9/11, too, to have maybe 5 or 10% of your assets in gold. But then you look at American households where their assets are valued somewhere close to $100 trillion. I doubt that they have as much as 1% of those assets in gold. Now, imagine the world, imagine this country, if our assets in gold. And gold, you have to remember, I mean, it's unusual in that it's not like a stock. A stock, you have to have a brokerage account to own it. Gold, you can really buy coins. You can buy it in many, many different forms. You don't have to have a stock market account. In fact, some people believe they'd rather have the hard metal and bury it in their yard. So it's very accessible to the common person. And when people started saving money on energy and gasoline, one of the recommendations I made, I think, was every time you save a dollar, put that dollar away. And then, you know, when you get enough of it to buy a quarter of an ounce of gold, do it. You know, buy gold jewelry. You know, treat your wife on Valentine's Day to, you know, a gold necklace, et cetera. I mean, it can be bought in many different forms. And when I say 1 or 1.5% of assets at most in gold, I'm not talking about investing assets. I'm talking about any way you own gold, whether it be through gold stocks, gold miners, or jewelry. Any way you own gold, that sum total in this country is around 1%. That's a ridiculously low number. And it's, you know, it just startles me. It really does. And you know, Chris, if you take one of these financial planning courses, and they give degrees out in it, NYU, I know, gives a degree out in it, and what the teachers will tell you, don't recommend gold. This is not a considered an asset that you should own. And how do you say that about an asset that has outperformed every other asset for more than 15 years and has done so through two very distinct and different periods? It makes no sense. Makes no sense whatsoever. And this is something the Chinese understand, you know, next to somebody who works for me. Is an exceptionally intelligent Asian, comes from China, fluent in Cantonese and Mandarin as well as English. And I asked him to translate for me a statement that the head of the party secretary in charge of gold, okay, the big honcho in China whose portfolio consists of gold. I'm using portfolio meaning his what's he in charge of for the government, not necessarily what he owns, though I'm sure he owns a lot of gold too. But anyway, he's the guy that reports to the big honchos there about gold, and he was quoted at a speech as saying, and you know, this is translation, that gold's part of the Chinese dream. Buy it. It's necessary. We're going to need it. And the Chinese encourage their citizenry to buy gold, you know, whether it be jewelry, whether it actually be gold bars, etc. And so does the rest of Asia. They like gold. In the Middle East, in China, you can go into banks and buy gold. Can't do that here. I mean, as I said before, it's accessible to people. But it's not something that they make it that easy for you to buy. Certainly the government doesn't make it easy for you to buy as they do in China. And just speaking of China for a second, if you ignore everything else, two things are true about China. One is they've been the largest gold miner now for about the last 5 or 6 years. I don't know how long, but for, you know, a number of years. And, well, that's not so unusual. They're the largest miner of a lot of things. But what makes it unusual for gold is that their reserves of gold are not that plentiful. They're almost de minimis when you compare them to the enormous reserves in a place like South Africa. Yet they are the largest miner. And this tells us that they're probably, and almost, actually probably is too weak a word, they're almost surely mining gold at a loss. And at the same time, they're telling their populace to buy gold. Now, some of the estimates, and again, these are pretty good estimates. I mean, you know, they're written by a person who writes a gold blog, Johnson, I believe his name is. He's in Singapore. He does a lot of hard work. And his work shows that China's accumulating like 2,500 tons of gold a year, or something like that. That's an enormous amount. It's sort of like, you know, goes along with, you know, this whole thread. India, too, massive amounts of gold. Middle Eastern countries, massive amounts of gold, all going from west to east. And China basically is talking the talk and walking the walk. They're telling people to buy gold, and they're mining gold at what is a current loss. Now, those are not things you do if you believe gold is not going to go up. They obviously feel very certain gold is going up. And to me, that sort of like says, well, you know, you can be very dramatic about it and say, well, it's the end of fiat currencies. Probably, to some extent, it is. But it's certainly going to mark a shift in monetary policy, in how we run our monetary world. I mean, negative interest rates, really? Give me a break. I mean, seriously, what are we going to try next? I mean, the one thing we refuse to try is, in infrastructure building and things like that. I mean, and the other thing that we refuse to try is setting inflation targets a little bit higher than 2%. I mean, even in the 1930s, we were willing to accept 5% inflation. It's reasonable for a period of time. I mean, there's something really wrong with how we're running this world. And when there's something really wrong with how we're running the world, you have to look for something else. I mean, basically, the heart of our monetary system since, I don't know, 1944, when in Bretton Woods, well, really since 1971, I should say. But since 1944, the dollar's been at the heart of our monetary system. And for a while, between 44, I guess 46 or 7, whenever the World War ended, and 71, the dollar and gold, pas de deux. But then everybody wanted to trade in their dollars for gold. I'm obviously shortening the story. And then it became really just the dollar and the petrodollar, et cetera. Everything started revolving around the dollar. And, you know, there's a whole history and, you know, that's what I'm writing about, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not working. That hasn't worked from the beginning. I mean, you could sort of mark the beginning of the end of this of the hegemony of this country in 1971 when we went off the gold standard. Now, I don't think we're headed for another gold standard, but I think we are headed toward a period in which the major currencies of the world, and maybe just the yuan, but it won't take all. It won't take more than one major reserve currency to say, we're going to partially back our currency with gold, or we're going to back all the international trade with gold. We need to do that. We need to sort of get hold of this system so that we cannot just randomly and rampantly print dollars, create negative interest rates, do all sorts of things, but the things that we need to do. And I think gold can be a great facilitator. Gold is very important on the way up, because when commodity prices are rising, because it's the only way you can really ration assets that are scarce. Everybody talks about copper, iron ore, et cetera. I'm much more concerned about germanium, rare earths, a whole bunch of very obscure metals that are critical for the running of today's world. Graphite, for one, and, you know, the supply chains that it takes to, turn these metals from ore into something that are usable. China is dominating this right now. I mean, this is what you don't hear about China. You hear about their debt, which is silly. They're going to turn that debt into equity, and it's family debt. It's not debt that they owe us. They owe it to one another. So, you know, that's a lot easier to manage than the kind of debt that we have, in which we owe it to the rest of the world. I guess, I don't want to go on and on and on. But the point is that everything, in my opinion, is shifting toward the East. And I think China does want control of its destiny. I don't think China is an especially aggressive toward other people kind of power. I think they want to secure the South China Sea because they see that as important to the East, but they don't want to secure it. It's not like they're trying to secure Florida or something like that. I mean, they're trying to secure waters that are very close to them. I mean, they also recently, took over the Piraeus port at the foot of Europe. And they also have a port at the foot of Pakistan. I mean, this whole One Belt, One Road thing is really, it's starting to come into focus. And you're going to need something other than the dollar to manage that. And you're going to need sort of, I would say, a flexible backing of major currencies. And that flexible backing would be gold. And another remarkable thing about gold is there's just not that much of it. There's probably about 170,000 metric tons, which, and that includes all the jewelry in the world, all the gold held by central banks comes to about 170,000 metric tons. And that might be worth, $8 or $9 trillion. I do the calculations, I always forget. $9 trillion is a lot of money, but not when you consider, the scope of what that money must represent. It must be able to back critical parts of our monetary and commerce, monetary system and commerce. And once you start talking about that, and once you sit down and put pen to paper, and you don't even need a four-function calculator to do this, you come up with, if it backs all the trade in the world, you come up with a gold price that could be, $10 or $20,000 an ounce. if it backs just the Eastern economy. And, you know, ditto. I mean, it goes on and on. We're not, in other words, headed, in my opinion, for a gold standard where the gold price is fixed. We're headed for a period in which we'll have a flexible backing of major currencies by gold. And gold will be allowed to rise in measured ways. But you're going to have to start, you know, or get there by seeing gold go to much higher values because there's just not that much of it to do it. And just one last comment. If you want to say that, you know, Lieb is just out of his mind, he's crazy, and if you want to believe, and, you know, I don't know, it's, I mean, I can't, I can say I don't believe it, but I can't say it with my hand on the Bible or anything. If you want to believe that China's going to crash and burn, what should you do then? You know, because a lot of my argument right now has been based on the rise of the East led by China. And if China crashes and burns, the best asset to own is gold. I mean, if you go back, and I have a book called The Golden Constant, which was written by, it's an academic book, was written by a professor at Berkeley. He passed away in the 90s, but he did all the spade work for it. And he has a running value of gold going back to the mid-16th century, 1550s. And the times when gold really does well, without exception, gold does well when there's deflation, when there are deflationary times, whether it be in the U.S., we've had four periods of deflation here, and in each of those periods, gold has risen. But you can go back to the 1550s when you're talking about England. Every time there's been a period of deflation, gold has risen. So here you have it. If China continues what seems to me to be an inexorable rise, there's going to be a new way of managing monetary policy. If I am dead wrong on China, if I look like a total fool on China, then you're going to have some real form of deflation in this country, and gold stands out. So when you put all these pieces together, the fact that gold has been so strong since China came on the scene at the beginning of the century, the fact that China's fate, whether it continues to rise or crashes and burns, is likely to propel gold much further, much higher. You know, how can you be surprised when you see gold go up? You know, why has it taken so long, I would ask. But, you know, it could be another false dawn. It could come back down a little bit again, but it's not going to come down a lot. It's going to remain, I think, you know, the best performing asset around. That didn't appear so in 2013, admittedly, when you owned it in 2013 and went from 1900 to 13 or 1200, I doubt eventually almost 1000. But that kind of correction still wasn't anywhere near as steep as the correction you saw in stocks between 07 and 09. So, I mean, you know, there you have it. I mean, you know, Americans are just out to lunch right now when it comes to this whole idea of gold. They should own it. They should own it. I don't care whether they buy a GLD. I don't care whether they buy gold coins. I don't care how, but they should own some gold. And this goes for, you know, middle class, lower middle class. Or if you can't buy gold, let me say buy silver. Silver, you know, historically even outperforms gold. I mean, you know, everybody thinks of precious metals, they think of gold. You don't have to, you know, come up and spend $1,000 or $1,200 on an ounce of gold. You can spend $15 on an ounce of silver. I mean, you know, great, buy anything that's precious at this point, because precious is precious, and that's what you should have your assets in. And I come back again and I say, Americans, probably 1%. I think I keep going between 1, 1.5. I mean, there are no exact figures on this, but I, you know, use flow of funds, et cetera, and, you know, tried to figure out how much jewelry Americans had. And I think I had to stretch it in order to get to about 1% of our assets. That's miserably low, miserably low. And if you think about it, how much, you know, better off, how much less angry would we be if Americans had it in their pockets, whether it be silver or gold, when I say pockets, I mean buried or owned, silver or gold that amounts to, let's say, 5 or 10% of their total assets, I think it'd be a, you know, I think we'd be a much less angry country today. I think the whole political dynamic would be different. And it has to change. And I think we're in the process of seeing some of that change happening. So I've talked your ear off. I'm sorry about
Not
that.
At all. In fact, you have just won our, Comprehensive Eloquent Soliloquy Award of 2016. you have surpassed John Williams of ShadowStats in length. And you have so far the title for the year, so we very much appreciate that. Certainly makes my life easier, although I wonder how much longer I'll have a job as a host. But at any rate, thank you so much.
Why do you wonder that?
Well, because I'm not necessary when we have such a verbose guest, but it's, again,
I think verbosity rather than, I hope there was some sense to what I was saying, but yes, okay, I do believe very strongly, and I have done a lot of research.
Well, you
this.
Covered so many
really
great
have.
Topics there, and we, of course, that knowledge is appreciated, but it did spark one minor comment here, and that is, keeping with your Asian theme, or theme of the East, you know, there's so much wisdom in some of the sayings that many of which I think have their genesis in Buddhist teachings. And one of them I've learned over the years is, I just think, very appropriate for gold and especially oil investors today. So I'm going to share it with you and with the audience, so it might be a good segue into the next topic, which I'd like to be West Texas Intermediate Crude. This little saying, and I hope I paraphrase it correctly, and that is, sit by the river long enough, and eventually the bodies of your foes will pass. You and I could sit here probably for 30 to 60 minutes and debate just how much wisdom from at least 30 different angles there is in that saying. But I'd like to focus on the importance of sitting pat, the importance of staying firm with your conviction of building a solid, diversified portfolio, and in particular, your idea of having a core position in the metals. But now that we've gone from $147 a barrel on West Texas down to as low as, I want to say, $25, $26 a barrel.
Yeah.
We could drop to 20, but does that really matter? If you take a 1 to 2 or even 5 year outlook, imagine the leverage that one could have at very low expense using LEAPS, you know, long-term equity options, threefold the leverage with virtually no time decay whatsoever, build that into your portfolio and forget about it for the next 2 to 5 years. I'd like your thoughts.
I can't argue with it. I mean, I do think oil is going to come back and come back very strong. Very interesting. It's a very interesting discussion, and I don't have a strong opinion as to why oil got so low to begin with, other than, you know, Saudi Arabia. I mean, they just kept the floodgates open and created this glut. And for what reason is something that's a little baffling to me. But, yes, I do think that it can't go on. I mean, the Saudis, for one, their all-in costs are about, some say, $100 a barrel. I mean, in order to maintain a balanced budget, that's not what it costs them to produce the oil. It only maybe costs them $5 a barrel to actually produce it. But in order to maintain security and social well-being in a country that's, you know, to some extent divided between, you know, two branches of Islam, they need a lot of money. And they've been having money problems. I mean, you know, with oil where it is. And I think they have to relent. And basically right now, I've never seen the world, to tell you the truth, Chris, where basically, supply is very close to, you know, 100% of what the world can supply. Yes, I realize Iran could come on with another 500,000 barrels, or probably not quite that much, and there might be a little bit of extra supply lying around here or there. But even in shale, everybody talks about, well, shale producers have done a remarkable job reducing their costs. Well, they haven't. Give some credit where credit is due. Some of the cost reduction has come about because of increased productivity, but the vast majority of cost reduction has come about because oil prices have gone down. I mean, shale oil is really a dog, in a way, a dog chasing its tail, because it relies very much on energy in order to get the energy. And it's not even clear to me how much excess energy you get when you are drilling for shale, because, you know, all those train loads of sand and water and chemicals have to be transferred to trucks of sand and filled with sand, water and chemicals. You know, people have to be fed. They're in the fields, et cetera. These are not, you know, when they're drilling for shale, they're, you know, and they're often in the middle of nowhere. I mean, there are water issues, there are cement issues, there are major, you know, it's a very, very expensive process. And yes, we may have gotten a little bit more creative in drilling, but it's not going to do that much. I mean, you know, if oil goes to $100 a barrel, what was that, $100 a barrel? And we weren't producing that much more shale than we are today. So, and it's likely to peak in 2020 no matter what. So it's hard for me to say that there's really any meaningful excess capacity in the world today when it comes to oil. So any kind of blip in growth, and I think it will come from the East, could send oil spiraling higher. And it could be a major reason. It could be the catalyst for, you know, sending gold massively higher, because I think it'll wake people up to the fact that oil is a very scarce commodity. And the fact that we're producing at nearly 100% capacity now, that's what's strange. That's the anomaly. That's the outlier. And, you know, how long can we do that for? Not very much longer. And I think you are seeing some bounce in oil. And I would guess right now that we have reached a bottom. And you were, you know, I think your $25 price was right. I would, you know, look, nothing in this world ever surprises me, but I would be a little bit surprised to see oil back down to 20 or 15, you know, unless we had some sort of cataclysmic economic event. And I think the real worry right now is that oil climbed too fast. I mean, that could be very tough. If all of a sudden you find oil, not even at 100, if you find oil at 70 or 80, you're going to find inflationary pressures in this country. And the Fed then will be between a rock and a hard place. You could have a mini repeat of 2008, for goodness sakes. But we're not there yet. Right now, I think oil is in kind of a gentle uptrend, and I just hope it doesn't become an accelerated uptrend. But I agree with your idea of, let's say, 2 or 3 or 4 year leaps. I think it's a terrific idea, and I think it's a way people could make a lot of money. I think oil is very tough, but what's tougher nearer term is probably gold because it's so driven by psychology, but longer term, not. It's, I think, you know, I think it's going much, much higher, but near term, it's very tough. But oil is also tough. They're all tough. Forecasting is very, very hard. Let me put it that way.
I agree with you. Now, switch gears once again to the precious metals. This idea that I think you started to allude to, that there could be considerable backing and filling. Let's just assume, for instance, that the lows are basically in for silver and gold. I would hopefully think, especially for silver, which has suffered relatively and much more profoundly. But my point is, let's say we're going to have a general gradual bottom, a long cup and handle. You know, these things can take time. And although we've had a year of a bottoming process, just take a look at the housing bottom of 2011-2012. That really took 2 or 3 years before a breakout. If you look at the U.S. stock shares market bottom, as you talked about, 2002 to 2005, you know, there was a 2 to 3 year bottoming process. So again, I guess the reason I mention this is I don't want our listeners to push all their chips in on the Texas No Limits table here, that drive to double down, that martingale fallacy that we fall into, the gambler's fallacy. Yes, we could see a dollar collapse at any time, and there could be a massive spike. That's what your core position is for. But maybe now, during pullbacks, it's always a wise idea to start increasing exposure.
Yeah, Chris, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, this goes back to your sitting by the river. If you sit there long enough, your foes pass by. I think one reason the Chinese have been such a successful civilization for so long is they do think longer term. They don't think about recovering in 10 minutes. And I think what you're arguing is patience. And yes, and, you know, basically, my feeling is right now gold will go down a little bit. We've been saying that, you know, we had a very nice run at the beginning of the year, and you'll pull back some, you know, and yeah, you'll have plenty of opportunities right now to buy. But one of the reasons is because you see oil around $40. But again, you know, if you see oil tick up and other things, you know, you might want to use your judgment and add to positions. But by and large, I think you will have a period of time in which gold, you know, backs and fills a little bit. I don't see, you know, if I had to bet on the next 5% or, oh, I hate to say 10% move in gold, I mean, certainly the next 5% move in gold, I would bet down, not up from here. Now, that could be a bad bet. I mean, I wouldn't bet a lot. I don't own a put option on gold, or I don't have any short positions. I mean, I'm long gold. I mean, I'm doing publication, a book on it, because I think it's going to $10,000, maybe $20,000. But for in the short term, no, I don't think you should, you know, just go plunging in. But I think you should aim for my own feeling, okay? Everyone has to decide for themselves. But I would be, if somebody came to me and said that they had 10% of their assets in gold, I would say that sounds like about, you know, what you should have. If you have more because you're a real strong believer, I wouldn't quarrel with you there either. But I think, you know, again, you're counseling, I think, patience, and I think it's a very, very good thing to be counseling at this point.
Is there anything else interesting that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Sort of look out a little longer term, you know, and try and relax. I mean, you were talking about, I think, Buddhism at the beginning of this interview. You mentioned it. And, you know, I'm not advocating Buddhism or a particular religion, but I sort of am advocating a kind of, you know, looking out there and, you know, trying to get rid of your anger, whatever it takes. Because I think America right now is just so angry. And it's so upsetting to see, you know, that.
This is a big problem, Doctor. And it's not just the U.S. I mean, we're seeing it crop up and flare up all over Europe as well.
You're absolutely right. Yes.
And timely comments sparked in my mind. Einstein, I think, maybe gets a little more press than maybe, certainly he would agree, than he deserved. But he had some wonderful, witty anecdotes that just have stood the test of time. And one of them that I've always recalled, I have maybe 10 that I hold on to dearly, but one of them that has really impacted me later in life, in midlife now, you know, as he matured, he became a vegetarian, but I embraced that a year and a half ago. He said, you know, most of the violence in the world would be ameliorated if we could embrace vegetarian.
I can't quarrel with you. I think it's a very, very interesting concept. I mean, I'm not a vegetarian, but I stopped eating meat. I mean, basically. I eat fish, I eat chicken, mostly fish and vegetables, ice cream occasionally. But yeah, I think being a vegetarian makes an awful amount, awful good sense. And just, you know, again, to come back to what you were saying about long-term and Einstein, what he said, that so much has stood the test of time. You know, a book I have right now in my hand, I actually have two translations of it, is I Ching. It's probably the first book that was ever written. I don't know, it's 3,000-4,000 years old. And I'm looking at this book, and unless you saw a man in the high castle, I mean, the Amazon.
I read Philip K. Dick's works, yes.
Yes, wow, yes. But very, very briefly, it's sort of like astrology, okay? You straws, et cetera, that you pick one of 64 pentagrams. And each of those pentagrams is supposed to have divination power, supposed to adumbrate, you know, certain things that are going to happen to you. Well, I said to myself, why should something like this have lasted for 4,000 years? And I read through these different translations of this book. I mean, they're translations by eminent guys. David Hinton is one of the leading Chinese translators in this country. Another one was is a Don at Cambridge. And what you'll find is that the book argues that in order to get the greatest effect, the greatest use of what these pentagrams are telling you, these 61 and these 64, is that before you read them, you want to enter a state of total relaxation. You want to rid your mind of everything that, you know, could interfere with your, you know, just looking at these things and absorbing.
Ego is the problem.
You've got to get rid of it. And once you get rid of it, then you can look at these pentagrams. Okay, so the book has, in my opinion, the pentagrams, which everyone focuses on, is not why the book has lasted for several thousand years. The book has lasted because what it's telling you, shed all that anger, shed all that negative energy, and then look at almost anything, and it'll look pretty good to you. And that is the advice of the I Ching. That's how I see it. And that's why it's lasted for so many thousands of years.
I can't wait to research some more. I'd like to share two books with you in the audience I just couldn't put down recently. And I really don't have a lot of time because I'm in the very last quarter of a dissertation and I'm trying to...
Oh my goodness, I'm sorry.
Yes. This is this amazing book, The Man Who Knew Infinity. Of course, that's the story of Ramanujan. Everyone knows it now because they made a movie out of it. But folks, it's a free book online and you've got to read it. I promise you, the author is more interesting than the subject. He's the best writer I have ever read. Now,
I'm going to pick it up, Chris.
No, yes. I have a copy. I'll send it. And then I have an even better book, and it's about Paul Erdős, the Hungarian mathematician.
Yes. He, I know something about. Yes.
The Man Who Loved Only Numbers. This is even better than The Man Who Knew Infinity. I couldn't put it down 100 pages the first night. It is the most easy to read, and it's filled with little mathematical anecdotes. So, and I know that you're a mathematician and a psychologist or psychiatrist, and you're going to love this. So I'm going to forward copies. I forward it to all my friends and colleagues. I'll forward these two books to your email address.
Thank you so much.
We really appreciate your time. It's just packed with need-to-know topicality.
And good luck with your dissertation. Okay, thanks for calling.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
He
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.